We don't always know how someone will respond to something until the situation actually happens. And I feel that way, especially with Luke right now. It's very interesting to watch Luke respond to different situations. He's young and everything's new. And so just this past Friday, we celebrated Christmas with my family. And the past couple of years, our kids and their cousins, they put on a play. And this year was The Grinch, and they did a great job. Well, a little bit after that, after the play, after the Christmas story, after the presents, then Luke and his younger cousin decided to put on a second show for us. And it was very entertaining. They were taking turns doing these various acts. And Luke had a segment where he taught us about patience. And it's something you have to learn around Christmas time. So it's very, very apropos. So here's how he said. He said something about how patience is waiting a long, long time for the thing that you're going to do after the patience. Like, that's a pretty good definition. So then after a few other segments, he had a segment where he taught us about the human body. That's a very big fascination for him right now. And he even cited his source. There's a book called The Human Body. And he said that's where he got all this from. So he taught us about our lungs and our heart. And then he also taught us about what our kidneys and colon do. So it's very educational. He's very, very eager to learn about the body right now. It's just something that very, very interesting to him. And it's exciting for me. I'm thinking, this is great. One of my kids can be a part of the medical field, and then I can call them whenever I want. I don't have to feel bad because it's my kid. And they have to take my calls, right? I'm their dad. But Luke is also very, very adventurous. If things are quiet in my house, I get really nervous, and I have to call out, ask where he is, what he's doing. He's very good about telling me where he is and what he's doing, but I have to ask that from time to time. Well, during one of these very quiet moments, all of a sudden he started crying out. And so I ran over there, and at first it did seem kind of serious. He's holding his finger, and I'm thinking, what did you do? And he calmed down pretty quickly, though, so I thought, well, maybe it's not that bad. So I had to pry his hand off of his finger to check it out. Everything was good. He was calm at that point until he saw a speck of blood on his finger. And then he gave the most blood-curdling cry that you ever heard, like he really chopped off his finger. And that's when I thought, well, there goes the medical field. So we're done with the medical field. All right, moving on. But you don't know what your kids are going to do until they have an experience like that, especially when they're young. The truth is, though, you don't know what you'll do in a situation until you're actually in that situation. If you're like me, though, you think you do. If you're like me, you think that you'll do the right thing. You know, when you imagine a situation, you think, I'm going to be the one that steps up and does what needs to be done in whatever the situation is. Now, I should know better because I know how I respond to blood. But whatever the situation is, you could imagine, I'm going to respond to it the right way. And when I read the Bible, I read these stories, and I think it's easy for me to think, and I'm sure I'm not alone, that I would be just like the person who's doing what God wanted in that story. It's easy to think. I'm sure for women who read these stories about Mary when she found out she was going to have a baby, you'd be just like Mary. You know, you would say, behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. Or like Joseph, when he wakes up from the dream, you just obey because, you know, it doesn't matter that what you're being told is unlike anything you've ever heard before in your life. Of course, you would just obey. When you read these stories, it's very easy to do that. Well, in our story this morning, story of the wise men, I think it's easy to imagine that we'd be like the wise men. We wouldn't be like Herod. Wouldn't be like the chief priests and the scribes. But the question we should ask is, what do our current responses, how do they show who we'd be in the story? What we're actually doing right now, how does that show who we would be like in the story? That's what we want to think about. There are flaws with everyone in the story. But when Matthew introduces these three different groups to his story in chapter 2, you want to be like the wise men. And the question is that how we're responding? So you could turn to Matthew chapter 2, if you're not already there. Matthew chapter 2, and we're going to look at this story. I'm sure you've heard this story a number of times. But we want to think about, as we're looking at this story, who we would be in the story, who we'd be like. Would we be like the indifferent chief priests and scribes? Would we be like the vehemently opposing Herod? Or would we be like the wise men who travel from afar and bow down to a baby king? Be the wise men. That's our goal this morning as we look at this passage. So as Matthew lays out the story, and starting in chapter 2 and verse 1, he introduces us to Herod, but he specifically refers to him as Herod the king. Matthew's being very deliberate. He's pointing out from the start that Herod is naturally going to be very concerned when he hears the wise men talk about the birth of the king of the Jews. And so what the first readers would have known, and maybe we don't all know, was summed up very well by Caesar Augustus. So even the emperor, the ruler of the entire Roman Empire, he knew Herod. He knew what he was like. And Augustus reportedly once said that it was better to be Herod's pig than his son. He was doing a little play on words in Greek, but he said that because Herod had gotten rid of his own sons when he was afraid that they were going to take over his kingdom. That's who Herod was. So Matthew has given us a quick little reminder of the fact that Herod would be very concerned about this because he was concerned about anyone who could potentially be his rival. And it was even worse actually at this point because he was ill. And so he was more paranoid than ever. And it's at this point that these wise men from the east appear out of nowhere. We don't know who they were. We don't know a lot about them. What the text says that they were from east of Judea, and they were probably, as best we can understand from the term magi, they are pagan sages. So they worship false gods, and they practiced ancient witchcraft, including astrology. That's the best idea we have based on what that word means, magi. So they believed that stars could give messages and warnings, and they're basically just pagan Gentiles. And they may have been influenced by Jewish writings, but they're not a part of Israel. So they had no connection to Israel's promises, but they're the ones who surprisingly showed up in Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." Now, when it says that they came to worship the king, these wise men were no doubt just saying, they could use that same word to just mean that they wanted to show the kind of respect you show to a king. But Matthew has already told us something about this child in chapter 1. He's told us that this is the one who is God with us. So as Matthew describes these magi's desire to show honor to this king, he's really saying that they're doing better than they even understand. And he does that by this word worship. Now, we don't know what the star was. We don't have any idea what was going on there. But it signaled to these wise men that the king of the Jews had been born. And just understand what they're saying. They're not saying that someone who would be king had been born. What they say is that an actual king has been born. So you can imagine what Herod is going to think about that. This is a guy who's willing to get rid of people closest to him whenever he feels even slightly threatened. So you can understand why all Jerusalem is troubled when they found out that Herod was troubled, because they know what he's capable of. And Herod gets to work right away. He's going to deal with this threat, but he's going to be very careful about how he does it. So he gathered the religious leaders of Israel. Now, what you need to know is that Herod had already taken control of the priesthood at this point. He was very nervous about people becoming too popular. So when the high priest became, in his mind, too popular, he deposed him and he put somebody else, made somebody else high priest. And so what had happened at this point was there was a group of people who had been high priest and had been demoted, and they were a part of this group called the chief priests. So he gathered them along with the scribes of the people. These were the experts on the Old Testament. And these were the best candidates that Herod could think of who would know where the Christ was going to be born. You got to understand, Herod is not actually a pagan. Not precisely. Even though he wasn't from a Jewish family, he wasn't born a Jewish person, he actually is descended from Esau. He's an Edomite. But his family had converted to Judaism. So he understands, he knows about the Messiah. That's why when they say the king of the Jews is born, Herod says, "Where's the Christ supposed to be born?" He knows this stuff. He understands about the Messiah. So he gathered all the chief priests and scribes, and he begins to interrogate them. That's the way this is worded. The Greek suggests that this is repeatedly, he's repeatedly asking him these questions. Why would he repeatedly do that? Because he doesn't trust them, and he knows they have every reason not to trust him. See, one other thing that we should know is that when Herod first got into power, again, he's paranoid about anyone who might become too popular, he immediately got rid of many of the leading priests and scribes. So they knew what he was like, and he knows what he's already done. So this is more like an interrogation. And the Jewish leaders, they didn't mess around. They promptly told him the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. And then Matthew tells us why they said that. He points to Micah 5:2, this prophecy. But he doesn't just quote Micah 5:2. He explains it a little bit. So instead of the word Ephrathah, which is in Micah 5:2, he puts in the phrase, in the land of Judah. He's explaining where this is. But he's specifically connecting Bethlehem to the tribe that he belongs to. And that is the very tribe that the Messiah was supposed to come from. So Matthew says that Bethlehem is by no means least among the rulers of Judah. If you compare that with Micah, Micah actually says that he's too little to be among the clans of Judah. And you think, well, are they contradicting themselves? No, Micah's looking at the situation before the Messiah comes. Matthew's looking at it now that the Messiah has come. Micah's saying, look, Bethlehem's an insignificant town. Matthew's saying it can't any longer be considered insignificant. It's just like these small towns you might see driving along the side of the road. You see that they're very proud of the fact that they're the birthplace of, say, Abraham Lincoln, or closer to our area, Orville or Wilbur Wright. And they're known to be the birthplace of this. Well, Bethlehem is now the birthplace of the most important person of all time. It is no longer an insignificant place. And then Matthew, he slightly deviates. Instead of quoting the last part of Micah 5:2, he quotes 2 Samuel 5:2. And that's where God had laid out his goal for David's rule. David was supposed to be a ruler who would shepherd God's people Israel. And what Matthew's saying is Jesus has come to fulfill David's role. Jesus is the promised messianic shepherd of God's people. So Herod's discovered that the king is going to be born in Bethlehem. And the story then continues in verse 7, where we see how Herod responded to this. In verse 7, he decides he's going to use the wise men as unknowing spies. Not going to tell them that's what he's doing, but that's what he wants to do. So he calls them in for a secret meeting. And he wants to know exactly when the star appeared. He's going to do some calculations to find out how old this king is that he needs to get rid of. But he doesn't tell him that's what he wants to do. He doesn't tell him he wants to get rid of the king. What he says is that he wants them to go and pay homage to this king and then come back and tell him so that he can do the same thing. He can pay homage to this king. And he sends them off, and there's every indication of the text that they haven't the slightest what he's up to. So verse 9, when you read verse 9, it becomes clear that this is not an ordinary star. This is not the way stars work. And in fact, the word behold tells us that this was unexpected, what the star does. It's not what was expected, because it's going before them, and it came to rest over the place where the child was. So they were probably aware of what we're aware of. Stars don't do that. So once they see what the star's done, it's shining, it's led them to the exact right house, they're exceedingly joyful. They have exceedingly great joy. They're ecstatic, and they go in, they see the child, and they worship him. I think that's incredibly important. This is one of the few places where we do get a glimpse of Mary. And Mary has a very, very positive thing said of her, but there are those who emphasize Mary. And what you see in this text is that Mary is not emphasized. Matthew's going out of his way to make sure that everybody understands who it revolves around. It revolves around the child. He doesn't refer to the child as Mary's child, her child. He refers to Mary as his mother. And it isn't, the wise men aren't bowing down to Mary and Jesus. They bow down to him. And they only give gifts to Jesus. And giving gifts, that was a way to acknowledge, to show honor to someone. It also acknowledged their superiority. So they were acknowledging that this little baby was their superior. And, you know, it mentions these three different gifts, different kinds of gifts. That's where you get the idea that there are three wise men. We don't know how many there were, but that's where that comes from. And they become known as kings because people thought that this was the fulfillment of Psalm 72:10 that talks about kings coming from Sheba and Saba and offering gifts to the Messiah. But they're not kings. The only thing we know about these gifts is that they were expensive. I mean, we know things about them, but the only significance that they really have in the story is that they're expensive gifts given to honor somebody important. There's whole sermons written about the symbolism of these gifts, but Matthew gives us absolutely no indication that we're supposed to take these symbolically for Jesus' divinity or for his death. The point is that these guys were giving honor to this person. But the significant thing is they of all the people in this story, they have the least understanding, the least knowledge about this Messiah. And yet they're the ones doing it. They're the only ones responding the right way to him. So as they're leaving, God warns them in a dream not to go back to Herod like he told them. And they obey. They slip out the back. And then that leads to this next turning point in the story in verse 13. Verse 13 is meant to arrest our attention. The way that it's worded, the word behold, and it's not translated in every, it is translated in the ESV. But behold, the first clause, the way that the verb is translated appeared, they're all telling us that what is about to happen is significant, it's important. Once again, God spoke in a dream through an angel of the Lord, and he instructed Joseph to get up and take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. And they're to stay there until Joseph receives orders to return. And then he tells us why. He says that Herod was on the verge. He was right about to try to get rid of this child, just like he'd done to many others plenty of times in the past. And so the way that the angel says this, the wording suggests Herod's not going to waste any time. He's going to do this immediately. And so Joseph doesn't waste any time. He immediately got up right then in the middle of the night, during the middle of the night, and he obeyed. And the description of what Joseph does perfectly matches exactly what the angel told him to do. So he obeys. But Matthew then adds after that that what happened was to fulfill something that Hosea said, Hosea the prophet in Hosea 11:1. And if you go to Hosea 11:1, in that passage, Hosea is talking about the people of Israel, how God had referred to them as his son. Israel was called God's son, and that God had, when he rescued them out of Egypt, he had called them out of Egypt. So what Matthew's saying here is that Jesus fulfills the pattern that God established with Israel. Jesus was going to make a similar journey out of Egypt, but first he had to get to Egypt. And it was through these events that God had providentially arranged for his son to get to Egypt, even through these various people's choices and decisions. Jesus is God's son in a way that Israel was not. Israel was picturing Jesus, really, pointing to him. When God called Israel his son, he did that with specific goals of eventually he's going to send his son. So Jesus is God's son in the greatest possible way. And when he came, God made it so that Jesus' experiences matched with Israel's. God was doing that so that everyone would see the story that God has been carrying out with Israel is coming to a climax. Everything that was happening for Israel was happening, was pointing to Jesus. And so then Matthew pans back to view Herod again, and he shows us how Herod responds, and Herod responds exactly how everyone knew he was going to respond. He's a paranoid king. He'd planned to use these wise men without their knowing it. When he finds out he's the one who got outwitted him, he flies into a rage. But it's still a calculated rage. Look at the only people who are affected by this are boys 2 years and younger. So he's very calculated, but it's a very horrible thing that he does. And all this just to try to desperately maintain his fleeting power. So notice, though, the way that Matthew tells the story. Each of the sections that we see here, and it goes on to another section, and he does the same thing there. Each section, Matthew shows that what happened, happened because it was part of God's plan. It fulfilled what God had already planned to take place. So in spite of all the chaos, in spite of all the different things that are going on, everything is happening according to plan. Hundreds and hundreds of years earlier in Micah 5:2, God said the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. That's exactly where Jesus is born. Luke tells us more about why, how God got him there. But Matthew is telling us, look, this is the one God promised. This is the Messiah. And then Hosea 11:1 shows that God is working out his plan in patterns. And what Jesus is doing, he's coming along to complete that pattern. Jesus is going to represent God's people. He's going to represent them. Only where Israel failed, and we could even stretch back further to Adam, where they failed, where they disobeyed, Jesus is going to obey. He's going to succeed. So Jesus is fulfilling that role of being God's son. Adam had that role. Israel had that role. Jesus is now going to do what their role was pointing to. The Father sent his son to Egypt just to show that Jesus was going to represent his people, that Jesus was who all of these stories have been pointing to. So the Christmas stories in the Bible, they are telling us that God has had a plan and that he's carrying out that plan. Sometimes he does this in miraculous ways. Sometimes he does it in very ordinary ways. Sometimes it's through the miraculous intervention that you see in the various things, a star that's miraculous, what he does with Mary. Sometimes it's through these ordinary human responses. He's carrying out his plan. So I just want us to think for a minute about the different ways that people in the story responded to the news that the Messiah had come, to the news of Jesus' birth, to the news of Christmas. So let's think first of all about the chief priests and the scribes. Notice their response to hearing that the Messiah may have been born. They do nothing. They did nothing. I mean, they may have been waiting to ride out the storm. They understand what Herod's capable of. And so they may have been scared to take a risk. They were among those others in Jerusalem who were troubled because Herod was troubled. But just think about that for a second. If the one that the scriptures had been pointing to, the promised king was going to come along, wouldn't you want to look into that? I mean, at some point, wouldn't you want to check it out yourself, just find out? They don't do that. They do nothing. The ones who know all about the Messiah did absolutely nothing. They appeared to be indifferent. It didn't matter to them. Before we look down on them for their indifference, we need to consider, though, what does that look like today? What does indifference towards Jesus, what does indifference toward his first coming look like? I think Douglas O'Donnell put it well when he writes that there are people in the world who are indifferent to Jesus. They know he was born in Bethlehem. His mother's name was Mary. He did miracles. He died on the cross. He rose from the dead. They know all this and they just don't care. There are lots of people like that in the world, but there are also lots of people like that in the church. If you quiz them on Bible trivia, they do just fine. But if you inform them God in the flesh is just 5 miles down the street, would you care to join me to meet him? They would shake their heads and say, oh, not this time. You know, the NFL playoffs start today. Or I'm sorry, it's the last day of this unbelievable New Year's sale. Or I'd hate to miss my Sunday afternoon nap. Maybe next time. Is that how we have responded to the Christmas story? Is Jesus central to our lives every day or just one day of the week or just one day of the year? Would we be modern versions of the chief priests and the scribes? We know all about the Messiah. We know the stories. We get it. But we just stay in Jerusalem. The fact is that their indifference doesn't stop God. The fact that his own people didn't care about his Messiah didn't stop what God was doing. But it did show us whose side they really were on. They were happier to maintain the little power influence they had with this wicked king than to take a risk for the sake of God's true king. Do we prefer to maintain our own little kingdoms rather than choose to sacrifice, to give up, to risk everything for the sake of Christ's kingdom? Jesus is worth the risk. So don't be like the chief priests and the scribes, but also don't be like Herod. I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? We think about his response, and it's far from indifferent. I mean, he's violently opposed to Jesus. Why? Because he's the king. I mean, he doesn't want Jesus coming in and taking away his power. But between the complacent people in our world who try to say Jesus is just a good moral teacher and the people who are vehemently opposed to Jesus, I think it's the latter who actually get who Jesus is, who understand the threat that Jesus is to them. They get it. They understand what the Bible is actually saying. Jesus is the King of the Jews. He is the Messiah. They know what that means. It means that he is going to rule the world. If he's going to rule the world, if they were to believe that, it would have a massive impact on their life. It would mean that they don't get to do what they want to do. It's not good news of great joy if you don't submit to him. So, people like Richard Dawkins or others who portray Jesus and religion as evil, what I can say to them is they get it. They at least understand that the Bible is not this kind of neutral idea that you can either take or leave. It is drawing a line in the sand. And you can either submit to this king, if this is true, you either submit to him or you try to stop him. Try to keep him from butting into your life so that you don't get to do what you want to do. If you understand what this story is saying. And yet, here's the reality. Could Herod stop him? I mean, of all the points in Jesus' story, isn't that the most likely point at which you could stop him? He's a baby. And Herod's a man with power. But could he stop him? He couldn't. Why? Because nothing can stop God's plans. And Psalm 2 gives us the same scene from a different vantage point. It speaks of the kings of the earth trying to stop the Lord's anointed, the Messiah. It says, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, 'Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us.'" And how does the Lord respond in verse 4? "He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision." Do you know that there was never a tense moment in heaven during this entire story? There was never a point where God was nervous. He knew exactly what was going to happen. He was laughing at the thought that Herod could successfully oppose him. And notice the way that Herod is referred to, the last way that Herod is referred to in verse 20. It says that the angel said there, "Those who sought the child's life are dead." It's a way in ancient languages to just refer generally to people. The only one who's actually died in the story is Herod. But he's not even mentioned by name. Now, this is a man who thought he was something. He clawed and scratched his way to the very top. And his last mention in this book is a nameless comment. That shows that all of his efforts to try to secure his own power, to try to secure his own life, they were pointless. You can oppose God all you want. You can try to oppose him. You can try to stop him, but you can't ever actually stop him. And the fact is, God will even use your opposition to carry out his plans. The last response we want to look at is the wise men. And of course, they're the good example, but you got to get a good picture of who these wise men are. They're not the cleaned up church folk you'd expect to show up to worship baby Jesus. Remember where the cleaned up church folk were. They were still in Jerusalem. These guys are wizards. They're warlocks. They're pagans. But they're not too good enough for the Messiah, like the chief priests and the scribes. And they're not focused on their own selfish ambition. These are guys who go and they bow down to a baby. It's the pagan men here in this story who are the ones who worship the Messiah. And it's part of this theme in Matthew's gospel. The outsiders. Matthew emphasizes this. The outsiders are the ones who come to Jesus. The insiders are the ones who reject him. And what that tells us about this overall story that God is at work in, that's even at work today, is that he does the unexpected. In the end, he does the unexpected so that we know he's the one who carried it out. Nobody else can take credit for accomplishing what God accomplishes. And what that means is that when we look around at who God welcomes into the kingdom, we should not make any assumptions. Anyone could be brought to respond to Jesus. It's not our job to figure out who is going to respond. It's our job to respond to the king with obedience, to believe in him, to submit to him like Joseph does to the Lord. And then when we're looking for others to join us, whom are we looking for? Are we looking just for people who have it all together? How do we respond to the people who seem the least likely to be used by God? I mean, the truth is, it could be either. It could be anyone. But what we learn in the story is that when you see somebody who's clearly far away from God, you need to realize that that's the very kind of person that God uses, that God does his work through. You do not give up on that person. God loves to do that, to work through the least likely person. So even though our responses are not going to stop God's plans in any way, they're not going to hinder God's plans in any way, what we do is not going to derail God. He is going to work through those who are indifferent. He's going to work through those who are violently opposed to him. He's going to work through those who submit to him. He's going to work through it all. But even though our plans are not going to affect, our responses are not going to affect his plans, our responses still matter. They demonstrate who we are in his story. Who are you in his story? You want to be those bowing to the king. Be the wise men. Let's pray. Father, we are thankful for the good news of Jesus' birth. But again, it is so easy for us. So easy for us to be distracted by the many things in this life, the many different blessings that you've given people throughout the world, that you've given to us, to be distracted by them and think that our goal for life is now and is this life. It's easy for us to get caught up with now and what's happening now and to lose sight of what is truly important, what is most important for our lives. It's easy for us to not think about the future, not think about the fact that we're all going to stand before this one who was born in these Christmas stories. We're going to stand before him someday. But we can defer that. We can think, well, we'll deal with that later. Pray that you'd arrest our attention, that you'd cause us to see the truth. See that Jesus is what matters most. That Jesus matters most every day of the year. not just on Sunday, not just on Christmas. That we would be those who live that out, that we would be those who truly believe that Jesus is our King, the King of the universe, the King who matters more than anything else. It would be demonstrated in our lives. Our lives would, people would be able to look at it and say, I know what matters most to you. That we would live that way so that the people around us would see it and glorify you. Pray that we would bring you the honor and glory that you deserve. So strengthen us by this story where we can see that the way that you work through the least expected people to be used. That we would desire to be instruments of your grace, not those that you work through in spite of ourselves. We ask for your Spirit to work in our hearts to be those instruments for your glory.